is a step below MLS and NASL. So it's a form of summer collegiate league sport, but using the most elite college soccer players in the country. Ancillary uses, and this sometimes gets lost in the shuffle of minor league baseball and operations, is these teams all put on other events besides minor league baseball. So within the stadium, you'll see car shows, Easter egg hunts, 5K runs, church gatherings, anything you can imagine, dog sniffing events. I mean, this stadium will have events beyond baseball. It truthfully is a new town hall, a community gathering space beyond just baseball. As I mentioned, Mike talked a little about youth tournaments. Just to put in perspective what it means to have 80,000 people going in and out of the exits of this stadium and that complex, and then just run you through a day of a family. And we're going to touch on a little bit the demand for this, but families show up. They may be staying in a hotel in Franklin or in another municipality, show up to the stadium at 8:30 to play their game for 2 hours. From 10:30 to 12:30, they go out to get lunch. They go out to get lunch somewhere in your community. 12:30 to 2:30, they play another game. Then they go out again and they go shopping. They come back from 4:30 to 6:30, they play another game. Then they go back out to dinner. And they go out in your community. Following that, they go back to their hotel, have a recreation. And this happens weekend after weekend after weekend, feeding businesses surrounding these facilities. And this is proven throughout the country. So as mentioned, in 2016 alone, there's 80,000 visitors planning to enter and exit through that youth tournament, whether it be for games, practices, and whatnot, throughout days next summer. Now I'm going to speak a little bit about stadium stability, franchise stability, talk a little bit about comparables that are in the marketplace and what gives confidence that this is going to be a very successful venture here in Franklin. At the outset, I will say that in Mary Claire's travels, she pointed out an economic study to me regarding an economic analysis doubting the economic impact of minor league stadiums, and I want to touch on that briefly. First, that study I thought lacked some credibility in parts. One part being that it quoted independent league baseball is only staying in certain areas for an average of 4 years at a time. The problem with that is the author used a study from 1980 to 2006. Independent minor league baseball in its common form only started in 1993. Even further down the road, and looking specifically at the leagues we're discussing, the Atlantic League, American Association, Frontier League, the average tenure of those teams at this point is 13 years. So even though that author may have studied leagues that have fallen by the wayside, we're not discussing those leagues. We're discussing the three major independent leagues that are currently in the market. And I have, and I'm glad I heard earlier that the city will be looking into data analysis regarding this project. I have a book of data analysis of independent leagues, specifically these teams. If teams even do fail, it's likely due to operators, which Mike has proven to be a great operator. When operators do fail, the stadium does not fail. Oftentimes, leagues move back into that stadium. So keep in mind as you read through analysis, there's a lot more to it than what may meet the eye, and I invite you to dig deeper in the analysis as this process moves forward. Even further regarding franchise stability, 33% of independent league teams actually exist in markets such as these, those being large MSAs with major league teams. And I want to point out two specific ones because I think they draw some parallels. The St. Paul Saints just opened their stadium this year and finished, averaging 8,500 fans a game. They're only 10 miles away from Target Field and Minnesota Twins. Kansas City T-Bones, right across the borderline to the World Series champ Kansas City Royals. Kansas City T-Bones have been around for approximately 10 years and are continuing to successfully draw fans to their games despite being in this large MSA. And those comparisons go on and on and on and on. Population comparables you can find in your statistical analysis. Incomes for Franklin fit right in the sweet spot for minor league baseball. Competition-wise, I know there may be some angst regarding the Milwaukee Brewers being in the marketplace. My only comment regarding that is, truthfully, these are different products. When you come to these games, the price point is completely different. We're talking an average of family of four for $75 versus going to the Milwaukee Brewers, which is in excess of $240 on average, according to Major League Baseball. So keep that in mind as we push forward about who our competition is. Typically, our fans come a 15-mile drive radius to our stadium. So any competition or people who cite competition that are in Beloit, Appleton, Kenosha, Madison, truthfully, that is not our competition. Our competition, movie theaters, Chuck E. Cheese, anything within our geographical area of that 15-mile footprint. I'm just going to try to wrap this up as quickly as possible. We talked about the economics. You're going to find studies that vary across the board because each stadium is different. The surrounding development's different. I invite you to really study this one wholeheartedly with considering the development surrounding it. And as I wrote up there, even any economic study you find will say that it's either positive or neutral. I find it hard to believe you'll find one that's negative. I also encourage you to call other municipalities with minor league stadiums to ask that government entity their experience with the stadium. The other aspect of stadium impacts is social utility and quality of life. The one thing, and none of those economic measures can put a dollar sign on, is the quality of life. Kiplinger's reports that minor league baseball brings a quality of life to municipalities, which retains jobs, it creates jobs, and creates future homeowners within those municipalities who see themselves living in an area that provides safe, affordable family entertainment for everyone. Lastly, the comparables. I want to finish with penultimately before I show you a visual. St. Paul Saints, as I mentioned, finished their first full season. Just some documents and articles that discuss that have all been positive and rave reviews about what it's done for the surrounding businesses, for the quality of life. Kokomo Jackrabbits, something that MKE Sports and Mike are intimately familiar with, had tremendous success in their first year, and I want to take some time to read an article in the Kokomo Perspective, a brief article about the impact. First off, the article was regarding the most influential people in Kokomo, of which Jax, the mascot, was listed as a representative entity of baseball in that community. Jax, the Kokomo Jackrabbits mascot, embodied the excitement and progress taking place in the city in 2015. Tough, playful, and lovable, the Big White Rabbit represents improved quality of life while inviting residents to enjoy an evening at the ballgame. The Jackrabbits may have been the best thing to hit Kokomo in years. Residents responded with enthusiasm to the new stadium and the team, filling seats so frequently that the stadium ranked 26th in nation in attendance for summer collegiate leagues, or teams and leagues. And the attractive stadium received its own accolades, being named the best ballpark in America in its class in its first year of operation. The Jackrabbits, with Jax as their mascot, also reached out to the community, holding special nights for a number of local charities, during which a portion of ticket sales were devoted to the organization and greater awareness was achieved for its programs. And Jax was sure to make a few special appearances at public events to keep the baseball fever climbing. While some were skeptical that baseball would provide much of an incentive for tourism or even community involvement, the amazing response proved the critics wrong. Jax and the Kokomo Jackrabbits represent everything that is good and growing in Kokomo, provide a level of goodwill to the community that hasn't been seen in these parts in decades. I invite you to replace Kokomo with Franklin in that paragraph and see yourselves in that position. So I'm going to wrap up finally with some visuals regarding what you see throughout America in terms of neighbors interacting with stadiums to know that we are not in a unique position. In fact, this happens in a lot of municipalities. You can go see these overheads. They're all out on the internet, but you can see this is River City in the Frontier League, the amount of residents that encompass this stadium, and they coexist on a day-to-day basis. This has been done before. We can do it here in Schaumburg, Illinois, just down across the border. That's a $40 million stadium with very large homes residing right outside the outfield fence. So with that, I apologize for the length of my conversation. As I mentioned, there's a lot more data that goes into this. We've studied it, the leagues have studied it, and they've vetted it, and I'm going to turn it back over and yield my time. Thank you.
Dick, before you get started, I am the mayor, but I have limited authority, and I'm afraid if we don't speed it up, we're going to get booted by the library. I want the folks to have an opportunity. Yeah.
We'll try and move very quickly. I want to introduce now Scott, who's been on the coaching staff at UWM's baseball team for 22 years, including the last 10 as the team's head coach. And as somebody mentioned, UWM is the only Division I baseball team in the state.
Thank you. Can you guys hear me? I'm not a lawyer, so I will not talk nearly as long as I am a baseball player, so I'm going to keep this moving. When they asked me to come and speak and really talk about how something like this can impact our program, for the 22 years that I've been at UWM, we've been trying to come up with a way creatively to put together a facility that would allow us to continue to be competitive and grow as the sport has grown in the NCAA. It's a tricky thing. I'm sure most, if not all of you people have been on the campus of UWM. It's a beautiful campus in a beautiful neighborhood. It's an urban campus, however, so that means the footprint doesn't allow for expansion. So we need to be creative. Something like this is exactly what we're looking for. Quite simply, I am in a competition. Much like if there's business owners in here, you are in a competition. You know, my job is to put together a good product. And to do that, you have to have resources. And, you know, as a coach, nothing is more important. Absolutely nothing more is more important and is more upfront than the lifeblood, which is recruiting. Having the ability to recruit, retain, and develop quality athletes is essential. We are at a crossroad right now. The way it's going in the baseball community around the country, the recruiting process has sped way up. And, you know, the high school legion type thing is going away, and it's now becoming a showcase year-round entity. So it used to be Northern Climates. When I grew up in Heartland, Wisconsin. I played baseball every opportunity. Then football season would come around, I'd throw my glove in the closet. Then the basketball season would come around, I'd throw my helmet in the closet. And then I'd wait for the snow to melt, and I'd ask my friend if you want to play catch. Those days do not exist anymore. This is 365 days a year. And so, you know, the multi-purpose facility, being able to have something like this in a community, this is going to happen somewhere. And it's going to bring in thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. Every single weekend, I'm somewhere at a showcase event watching people come into a community, spending their money, and showcasing their kids' abilities. And not only that, 7 days a week, those places are pumping, training. It's just the way things go. People are not multi-sport athletes nearly at the same level that they used to be. So these type of places, they flourish. So like I said in the beginning, I'm in a competition. You know, we put together the toughest schedule possible from coast to coast. And nobody's going to feel sorry for me that we have a facility that does not allow for us to really recruit, retain, and develop to the level that they do. So something like this for us could be so impactful. And watching what Mr. Zimmerman has done with The Rock and the impact that that has had from a baseball standpoint has been extremely impressive. It's first class. You have the place pumping nonstop. And to me, what better outlet is there for young people to have a place to go and play baseball? You know, when I say that, and I'm at a showcase in September, and I look around, there's a foul ball coming at me from a 75-year-old who hit it. So it's neat to see, you know, the young people, the old people, everybody playing and enjoying the game, and it's never been more viable than it is right now. From a visibility standpoint, obviously the university, we have outreach all over the community. We built the freshwater science building. Off Lake Michigan, Innovation Park out in Wauwatosa, Panther Arena downtown. This would be another way for us to extend, you know, our tentacles out a little bit and continue to become visible. I'm sure there are some UWM alums in here right now. Yeah, there's thousands of them, tens of thousands of them in the Milwaukee area. And this would be a great way for us to showcase our university. Certainly a way to showcase my program, our program, as the only Division I program in the state of Wisconsin. You know, we are going all over the country representing Wisconsin. More than just UWM or Milwaukee, we're representing Wisconsin. We need to do that in a first-class manner. I'll move fast here. But I think also, you know, listening to everybody talk, I think it's an opportunity for Franklin to become visible to the rest of the country. With these showcases and tournaments that will be held, you are going to bring in people from coast to coast and an opportunity to really showcase what a great community it is and what it has to offer. And you get to do it around the nation's pastime, which for me is dear to my heart. And then lastly, you know, as a coach, parents hand over their sons to me, and I have an objective to take care of them. But I also feel a responsibility that I make sure that we have a good, that they come out of here with a good experience. You know, for the people in here that went to college, I'm sure you can look back at those times fondly, and probably more times than not, you're going to say those are the best times of your life. And, you know, we have to have a place to play for our guys, which is going to allow them to really flourish and have a great experience. So that when they do look back, you know, whether they got a lot of base hits or not, they can feel a sense of pride. And I think something like this, with their leadership, you know, I think it's something that I know that I can take those kids when they're handed over to me and hand them back to them, knowing that we had an impact in that way. And I think Franklin Community is the exact type of place that could really do it. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Coach. I'm just going to quickly introduce Bruce Keyes, and he can quickly address the couple of the environmental issues.
Thank you, Dick. I actually don't have a lot that I need to say. I will make a couple of observations, and that will really cover my remarks. The first thing that I would note is that the reuse of landfills like this is not new. And in the last decade or so, we've seen significant redevelopment, adaptive reuse of landfills. The most immediate example that comes to my mind is the city of Glendale, which is advancing athletic fields on a landfill in their municipality, which is on a track a little bit ahead of this one. The landfills, I understand, reasonably, citizens are curious and concerned and want to know what will occur. Most of this is addressed through, all of it is addressed through regulations, working with the consultants, working with the Department of Natural Resources. Over time, they have become very sophisticated in the management of landfills, and they understand what the issues are inherent in redevelopment and reuse of landfills. I can assure you that the project won't proceed without all of the necessary approvals. The Milwaukee County is currently underway for revamping the methane system. There's specifics on the construction of these types of facilities on landfills. And none of this can occur unless they have sign-off both from the City of Franklin, the consulting team, and then, of course, the Department of Natural Resources, which has administers the very close regulations. The last thing that I would observe is that there are a number of steps that have to be taken. There are issues about soil management, the methane that people have expressed concerns about. We have a team that has demonstrated their ability to comply with the regulations and their ability to do things the right way for development on landfills. And so that's really all I need to say. If there are questions, I can answer them. But this is closely regulated by Department of Natural Resources. The health of and welfare of the citizens is foremost in their mind. And as I said, nothing goes forward until they've approved.
Okay. So now we're going to move across the... There we are. We're going to move across the street and point out to you that the mixed-use buildings that are proposed along right on Rawson Avenue, those will be office, retail, possibly some additional residential. Final uses will be completely dependent on the market demand. And then the larger piece of it is multiple buildings that would include 200 or thereabouts luxury rental apartments. The idea would be that we would have two-story buildings adjacent to the Stonehenge neighborhood with larger three-story buildings, and we'd have nothing over three, but through the higher buildings closer to Loomis Road. We would, once again, as with the tournament complex, would maintain an 80 to 100-foot landscaped buffer between the apartments and the adjacent properties. And there will be a number of amenities, including clubhouse and swimming pool and that sort of thing. So with that, I'm going to quickly introduce Blair Williams, who's the founder and president of Wired Properties. He's earned a stack of degrees from UW-Madison, including a law degree and a master's in real estate. And I think Mick mentioned that before he started Wired Properties, he and I were colleagues at the Mandel Group, and he will be the lead developer in the mixed-use and multifamily portion of the project. And Mayor, we only have one other speaker after this.
Good evening. I appreciate the time and opportunity to be here tonight. The fact that I have a law degree suggests I'll speak a long time, but I do want to be brief. But I also suspect that this is one of the topics about which there's a high degree of sensitivity. So I don't want to give you short shrift, but I'd like to talk about some of the things that kind of drive the way that I approach my business. When I founded my business in 2005, I just had a vision for doing things a little bit differently than I had been exposed to doing them and had opportunity to do them in my previous positions. Most notably, I developed a very strong passion for this notion of community, and I came to the conclusion that great communities don't just happen, they are made, and the contribution that creates those community comes from the members within that community alone. And I also came to the conclusion that there are types of effective planning that can deeply influence how a community reacts to the built environment. My developments over the course of time reflect my passion for this notion that communities are made. And I've done a fair amount, in fact, probably more than most in the market, of these mixed-use, neighborhood-oriented developments. The image behind me right now happens to be from Drexel Town Square. We were selected by the city of Oak Creek to be the developer of their brand-new Main Street, stretching from the new town square to the north towards Drexel. And our first two buildings happen to be comprised of apartments over retail. Well, that actually reflects a pattern based on what we've been doing in the past. These two buildings are located in Shorewood, Wisconsin. The building on the top, you'll note, goes from three stories to four stories. Again, these two buildings across the street from each other are intended to establish a pedestrian scale. And what's really important about these types of developments is the level of energy that they create and that they support. This is Mequon Town Center, which we are completing right now up in Mequon. This is on the corner of Green Bay and Mequon Road. I would invite you to check that out. Colectivo is open for business. Cafe Hollander should be opening sometime in about May 1st. And this is another pattern for us. We strongly believe that for local retail to work, you have to start with local retailers. When we look at what we want to accomplish with mixed use, we look to the community in which we're located and try to identify those types of retailers that will reflect and support the identity of the neighborhood in which they're located. And in each of our developments, we believe that we've crafted and curated a collection of retailers that are deeply expressive of the neighborhoods in which they're located. But we don't do just mixed use, and this is one of the reasons we believe that we're an appropriate fit for what we're trying to accomplish here in Franklin. This is Lily Preserve, which is a development in Brookfield. You'll note it's a three-story building. It has pitched roofs. It's not a terrific rendering, but the site plan on the bottom of the scheme shows a central green. And then there are three buildings located around that central green. And the largest of these buildings is about 26 units. So we've worked in a variety of scales, in a variety of contexts. And what we've always worked very hard to do is to cultivate a built environment that rewards not only the local community and the neighbors, but also fosters a sense of pedestrian activity. And we think that the connection to what is happening across the street in Ballpark Commons is deeply important. So why do we think that apartments are important, and why at Ballpark Commons now? And I know this notion of apartments can be one that raises certain concerns. Well, first, Franklin has a very unique opportunity here to leverage a truly dynamic and remarkable private investment into a placemaking and community-creating opportunity, and we really think that can happen here. And the critical mass of the overall development creates a significant opportunity. But what we really believe is that there needs to be a strong residential foundation, and there needs to be a gradient of intensity of use as you move across the development. And Ballpark Commons is an incredible dynamic environment. What happens south of Rawson, we think, should be something that is accretive to the opportunity that's created by that Ballpark Commons investment. Well, the coach talked a little bit about competition, and I think there's another level of competition that everyone should think about, and that is that every municipality competes every single day against its neighbors for the next taxpayer, for the next resident, for the next business. And that really is a dynamic moment of competition, particularly today. So what we know is that we can point to demographics, and Professor Epler here will have some conversations about some things to say about how all of these things work together. But the market today is different than the market was yesterday. And what we know is that in communities like Franklin, which have such strong dynamic emotional attachments with their residents, folks have a tendency to stay in their houses longer. And as they stay in their houses longer, often they stay past that point at which they might otherwise sell their home if they had an option within their community. And that creates a challenge because any municipality needs to have a consistent evolution. There needs to be new young families that move into the community and have an opportunity to raise their children the same way that the aging population did. By creating a very high-quality luxury rental option within Franklin, you actually create the opportunity for folks to age in place in Franklin but shed themselves of the obligations and responsibilities of home ownership and maintenance and snow and lawn care and all of those things. And that frees up their homes for the next generation. And it's very important to note that today's apartments are not like yesterday's apartments. This is not 1985. It's not 1995, and it's absolutely not 2005. In 2005, this development, built exactly the same way, may have been condominiums. But it's just not that environment anymore. Life changed with the Great Recession. Liquidity changed. People realized that life doesn't move at the same pace and things can change quickly. But I think here's something that's very important, and Professor Epley will talk about this. We're talking about apartments that cost, in the developments that I've been doing, a two-bedroom apartment with an average rent of $1,500 to $1,900 a month, a two-bedroom and den apartment with $2,500 a month. What starts to matter is, what is the household income required to support those rents? We're talking about household incomes north of $70,000 a year to be able to even qualify to rent many of the apartments that are being developed around metropolitan Milwaukee. Those are not any kind of subsidized housing. That's not any kind of rent-reduced housing. Renting is what condominium purchase was in 2005. And it really is a different moment in American history, and Professor Epley will talk about that. So who's the market here? Well, it's not the millennials now, but that's not who we're trying to attract with the apartments either. But the millennial market is what Franklin needs to attract going forward if it wants to continue to remain vibrant. You need today's millennials to be tomorrow's home purchasers in Franklin. The total number of middle-aged housing households in the country outnumbers households under 35 years old by 3 to 1. That's the biggest chunk of the American market today. And 20 million, half of them, are in this middle-aged demographic, and 10,000 people are turning 65 every day. I look to the market that's the older portion of the demographic, and if you look at what we've done in Shorewood or Mequon or our other markets, my average tenure of renting in Shorewood, I have 24 apartments in one of those buildings. I have 14 original residents 5 years later. The average tenure of renting at this point is over 3 years from my residents in Shorewood. Those are long-term stakeholders in the community. And renting just simply isn't what it used to be. Okay, so what needs to happen? I'm going to summarize this. Municipalities, just like what we're doing in other markets, need to become somewhat forward-looking and a little bit more urban in some of their characteristics. Urban preferences are on the rise in the baby boomer generation. It's well documented. Convenience, walkability, the ability to live your life closer to you without having to get in your vehicle and driving to another municipality to accomplish the things you want to accomplish in life. Those are the things that millennials, who all agree, by and large, they're going to move to the suburbs someday, but those are the types of suburbs they want to move to. And for all of you that are homeowners in Franklin today, the one thing you can hope is that somebody on the back end wants to buy your house when you're ready to sell. Professor Epley will talk about how these types of developments don't negatively impact home values. I'm going to let him do that. He's the academic. But what I can tell you is you need the community to be as attractive as it can be in order to create that forward market that you need to sell your homes at some point in the future. The last thing that I can say is that these sports and entertainment anchored mixed-use centers, and I've been involved in a lot of mixed-use centers at this point, they draw from a larger than typical trade area. Franklin is a remarkable community. The more people know about Franklin and the more people that know about Franklin, the stronger your market will be when you try to attract that next resident, that next business owner, and that next taxpayer. And that's what we would look for as you compete against the communities next to you. And I really do believe that municipal success will be determined by the ability of the municipality to match their planning expectations to consumer preferences and future growth. And it really is through effective public-private partnerships that you can create enduring communities that really meet those types of consumer preferences. Thank you.
And last but not least, Dr. Mark Effley, who is a professor of finance and the Robert Bell Chair in Real Estate at Marquette University. Mark served as the interim dean of the Business Administration School at Marquette from 2012 to 2015. He's widely published and is a frequent speaker and serves on the board of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago. And I only read about half of what I was going to say about this.
Yeah, there you go. Home Warriors. Mayor, council, staff, neighbors, and mothers, thank you for welcoming me here today. So Blair spoke about the development, the buildings that are going to be in place. What I'd like to speak about are the people who will likely reside in them, the impact of multifamily residences on neighboring real estate owner-occupied, as well as at the end, give you an example of the type of resident that will be in these facilities. So a quick overview. So right now we're in a period of super affordability of single family housing. If you look at this, it's the most affordable it's been ever since NAR started keeping the data. This data goes back to 1982. However, if you look at home ownership rates in the United States, they have dropped precipitously right at the time when it's most affordable. That's a conundrum, right? So why is that going on? I want to talk about that for a little bit and the type of residents that might be coming to this type of development. When we start looking at the overall demographic impact, so I've got data here going back to 1947 right up to the current. The top line, that's the only one I'll focus on here to save some time, Mr. Mayor, is looking at married households. In 1947, it was 78% of the population. Today, it's 48% of the population. Married households with kids in them is only 20% of the population. Why do I talk about this? We need to know about this to understand the type of housing unit you will need in Milwaukee, in Franklin, in Whitefish Bay, and other communities around here. From there, one of the reasons why some of these household sizes are dropping is marriage rates are getting higher and higher. So what we have is we have residents staying in multifamily housing for longer periods of time, echoing some of Blair's comments. From there, it should be noted, using this next slide here, what we have are three different lines and data going back to 2006. And this is looking at who is occupying, who are the new renters out there. And you'll start to look at the red line. The red line is largely the millennials. And you'll find since 2010, they've added very few new, very little demand for new housing. But when you look at the green line on top, 400,000 units a year have been demanded by largely empty nesters aged 55 and over. What this type of housing is likely to provide is the community to age in place, go from having a larger single family home into something that might be more viable for them to age in place and stay in the community. From there, this next slide looks at Lori Goodman's work on likely home ownership rates in the future. She goes through a whole series of demographic, mortgage underwriting, among other things, and suggests that home ownership rates will drop to about 60% over the next 15 years. I've looked at this closely. I've had dinner with Lori. I know her well. She works for the Urban Institute, which is a nonpartisan group. And she's suggesting that over the next 15 years, housing or households will demand, two-thirds of the households will demand multifamily as opposed to one-third single family. So what we're seeing is almost a complete inverse of what we have. About two-thirds own single-family homes today, but the demand over the next 15 years for housing is going to be multifamily. From there, let's take a real quick view of the types of amenities that millennials and people who age in place want. They really want retail, restaurants, and so forth. That's not a surprise. Recreation trails, some of that's being recommended here. And they want it to be pedestrian friendly. They want a mix of households, and that mix of households will afford folks who are starting their careers at NML and such to stay here in the community. But also, those are your future home buyers who will buy your homes as they gravitate from being unmarried to married, and then ultimately with kids, and likely move on to a single-family residence. And then from there, it's great to have empty nesters in some of these units as well. Critical mass is important. I think we started talking about that. You could look at a couple of your larger big-box facilities in this community, and they're empty. Greater mass creates greater demand for retail services in a higher scale of retail services. So let's talk for a minute or two about the impact of multifamily residents on single-family residents in the neighborhood. And so I could go into great detail each of these studies, but overall what they are, they're called hedonic pricing studies. And what they do in its simplest form is you'd want to take what's the price of a single-family home next to a multifamily development. And then you take the price of a single-family home that's further away that might not be impacted by that multifamily development. And you go, well, if we just look at those two average prices, we can get the difference and you can figure it out, right? However, it's not that simple. The age of the homes in one neighborhood versus the other might be different. The school districts might be different. The size might be different. Any number of things. So these hedonic pricing models account for all these attributes. The house size, number of bedrooms, number of bathrooms, quality of house, as well as age of house and other things. And one of the things they also look at is what are the neighborhood attributes, including proximity to multifamily residences. And across these studies that come from the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard that are published in MIT's Center for Real Estate publications that come from the University of Wisconsin have found the following. They have found that multifamily residences do not negatively impact single-family residences in the neighborhood, and at times can marginally enhance appreciation rates. Let me give you an example of the type of tenant that might be in here to allow you to think about this more closely as it might affect you and your home. I trust several of our neighbors. So going to what Blair suggested before, said let's look at the rent to one of the residents in this development. What we're really talking about here is a unit size of about 1,100 to 1,600 square feet for about 60% of the units, which are two-bedroom, two-bath units, or two-bedroom, two-bath with a den. The rent is going to be about $1.50 a square foot. These are premium units. So you take $1.50 a square foot times about 1,300 square feet, and you got just under $2,000 a month in rent. Now, to afford $2,000 or $1,950 in rent, you can regularly pay about 30% of your income to housing costs, right? That's a HUD-based number. It's been in unmortgaged underwriting for years as well. If we divide that $1,950 by 30%, we get the income required to afford that unit on a monthly basis. And what we have here is $6,500. If we then annualize that number, we get to about $78,000. I then look at the median household income for Franklin, and this is slightly old. It's for the 2008 to 2010 period, and the median household income was around $75,000, $76,000. The type of unit that will be developed here will reflect the type of people we already have in this community. Okay? Let's go on and summarize. So first off, if you're really looking to bring folks into your community, two-thirds of households in the future will demand multifamily housing. Multifamily housing allows residents to age in place. I am a resident of Whitefish Bay. We recently added infill development right in my backyard. I actually look at multifamily development. The average age of this new development in my in the Whitefish Bay community is 61 years of age. It's a great place to allow folks to age in place. From there, multifamily housing, as I quickly went through it, there's so much more I can go through, Mr. Mayor, but I will not, does not generate a negative impact on single-family housing. And finally, the multifamily residents will have incomes in a socioeconomic profile that is reflective of the, of your neighbors here in Franklin today. Those are my comments.
Okay, so that's our story and we're sticking to it. As I said, we're not asking for a specific approval tonight, but really for the opportunity to continue to work with city staff and consultants and move forward. But I will just quickly touch on an issue of some import, and that is the possible use of tax incremental financing. We're aware, and I'm sure many of you in the room are aware as well, that the city contracted with Grafe Engineering Firm some time ago to examine the TIF potential in three different locations within the city. We are working through our costs of infrastructure and environmental issues and project costs. We're not making any kind of a specific request. We're not talking about any numbers tonight, but we are prepared to work with the city and the financial advisor to take a look at the potential for TIF participation. So, with that, Mr. Mayor, we'll be happy to try and respond to any questions.
Okay, this is a concept review for the Common Council.
Right.
Is there any Common Council member wishing to ask a question? Everyone will help, and please use the mic.
Really, I'd like to hear from the residents. I'd like to hear mostly from the residents, but I prepared 10 questions.
Which you may never be able to ask.
Most of them, I think, were already addressed.
Mayor, it doesn't matter where I go, this is
Mayor. Get up there. Kristen, why don't you get up there and use that mic?
Sorry for all the extra noise. Can you hear me okay? I'm talking about pretty close. How's that? Okay. I was wondering if you could talk more about what type of retail and restaurant or hotel tenants you're targeting or expecting for this development, and have you put your thoughts into what features and uses or building types will be viewed from Loomis at this location?
Claire, sure.
Claire?
Yeah, there we go.
Red is on.
I'm getting nothing. Here, let me just come up there and answer that one. I think one of the challenges and opportunities of this site is the relationship between Loomis and Rawson right now. So as Loomis stands right now, I like to believe that a long-range plan for Area A is going to contemplate what happens exactly with all of the connections throughout the area. That said, what we've contemplated to date is that the buildings presenting to Loomis would be distinctly residential in character. There's no direct connection off of Loomis, which doesn't really support any type of retail buildings along Loomis proper. As you look along Rawson and the types of retailers that could be there, I can't say with any kind of conviction at all which specific names we would attach to this particular development. I think there's lots of pieces that all need to go together. We need to understand what type of uses are directly across the street in Ballpark Commons, what is the hotel, and what restaurants would go there. I can tell you that if you look at my previous developments in each of the submarkets in which I've done those. We have concentrated on local restaurant brands, and we would continue to look towards those types of restaurants to come in and provide the same type of local experience that they do in their other submarkets.
Okay. I guess I was wondering if you were considering some type of phasing on the project, and if so, which one would you consider might be first, or if you feel it would be better to address developing everything at once to pull each project upon each other.
In terms of phasing, the most time-sensitive piece of this is the baseball stadium and the need to get that up and running by next spring, a year and change from now. That is consistent with the letter of intent that we have with UWM for their team, as well as the timing of the new major league professional league team that would begin. As far as the apartments, most likely that would start more in the fall of next year, and because those are multiple buildings, it will be easy to phase them and hopefully continue to keep building them on a consistent basis while they're filling up.
Alderman Mayor.
Yes.
Alderwoman.
That would be me. I guess I have a couple of questions regarding TIF. I don't know who would want to talk about that.
Well, we'll throw it somewhere.
Okay. So the last comments being made were that you were thinking about TIF and possibly so if that's the situation with the property that's county owned, I don't know if this is working anymore. With the property that's county owned, how would that assist the TIF?
Okay. Let me answer the second question, and then I'll ask Mike to speak to the first one. For any portion of this development or any other development that would be inside of a TIF district that is tax exempt, we would end up negotiating with the city what's called a pilot agreement, and pilot stands for payment in lieu of taxes. So there would be a negotiated agreement by which we would make a payment in lieu of taxes.
How much of the land north of Rawson Avenue is county-owned, acreage-wise, and not?
I'm not sure how well you can see. All of this is county-owned, except this kind of dotted line along here.
140 acres.
That is the land that we're acquiring from the DOT. So as this is laid out, the sports complex and the stadium would be all on county land. And the hotels and restaurants and so on would be on privately owned land.
So there is taxable land for the city of Frankfort.
Absolutely.
Everything south of Rawson too.
Everything south of Rawson is privately owned and taxable.
Let's do this so that the constituents can hear the question. The question revolved around what lands are available that are taxable in the proposal, and you can't see there. No. That line right there, this way, and it comes right here, and then all of this. So that was the nature of the question. And then the applicant committed to a payment in lieu of taxes for the remaining property, or to be negotiated.